I don't know who's leading. I think we, by now we really know each other. We don't have to. But anyway, for the benefit of those who don't know us, that we are the Select Committee on Labor and Public Enterprises. And let me say, this department really knows, understands what the Select Committee is. I hate when the minister was debating, definitely. She was giving us breakdown of everything, pet problems, and we appreciated that. It shows us that when you are here, when you go back, you tell the minister exactly what the Select Committee wants. And thanks for that. I'm Priscilla Temba, the chairperson of this committee, representing Mpumalanga in the MCOC. So, honorable members, can we introduce ourselves and then we go straight to the business of the day? Doesn't look like it's going to be a long meeting. Honorable Dibir.
Good morning. My name is Onyao Dibir. I am from the Western Cape. I'm a member of this committee. The last time I looked.
I'm Aron Groenewald, member of the committee and representing the Northwest Province.
Good morning, gentlemen. My name is Zola Lenzana from the Eden Cave.
Oh, thank you,
man. Yeah. Rather than the the member of the committee.
Good morning, Shen. Good morning, everybody. I'm Priscilla Jacobs from Free State.
My name is Sam Morotoba. The DDG is responsible for public services.
Ian Matsoon, Director of Connected Body.
Led Gerda, the Director General.
Mukadi Pela, Department of Labor Communications.
Candice Mariana, Department of Labor Communications, Western Cape.
I'm Herbert Mkize from the Office of the Minister of Labor.
My name is Honorable Member. My name is Colam Nere, Office of the Minister of Labor.
I'm Colonel, Department of Labor.
Good morning, everyone. Ismail Hussain, Parliamentary Monitoring Group. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Loli Pivis. I'm the committee secretary.
Good morning. My name is Arif Boskati, Cornell Advisor for the committee.
Good morning. My name is Rina Barita, and I'm the researcher for the committee.
Thank you very much, Adam. Mr. President, I don't know. We didn't hear the apology of the DGs. Are you going to do that for us? Because usually we know he comes.
Yeah, I was about to make that apology, Chairperson, and Director General. We're not able to attend today, but we are deployed to make the presentation. Can we continue, Chair?
Yes, without any waste of time, can you tell us about decent work?
Yes, we're going to do
the agenda.
Yeah. Thank you, Deputy, honorable members. We're going to do the presentation in two parts. The first part of decent work, Mr. Masun, who is the Director Collective Bargaining and who is a member of the Technical Implementation Committee for the Decent Work Country Program in South Africa, is going to do the decent work presentation. And then Mr. Semarotoba will do the presentation on the cooperative immediately after that. So it's up to you, Chair, whether we have a discussion after the first presentation or we do both presentations and then have discussions afterwards.
Okay, let's do the both presentations and then we will zoom into questions and discussions after that.
Okay, thank you very much, Chair. Mr. Masood.
Thank you very much. Chairperson, honorable members,
Good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to talk to you about decent work, which has quite some history in South Africa, but also internationally. So I thought I should just talk a bit about what the decent work agenda is. That's more giving the background, where it comes from, and then speak to the South African Decent Work Country Program, which was launched in 2010. Say a bit about what's been happening in South Africa, and then to zoom in on some of the more practical aspects about how the Decent Work Country Program actually works, how it's governed, how we implement, and then Ms. Moritoba will take over on the DOL involvement in the cooperative. We did forward a copy of the presentation and also a document which I will refer to as we go, which is the South African Decent Work Country Program document. That's the blue big document. And then a very lengthy, I think about 55-page implementation report. Now, I'll refer to that as we go. I think there's a lot of detail. I'm not going to go through all of that. But it's there to give you a sense of what's happening on the ground, and I'll explain it as we go. So, Chair, what is the decent work agenda? Well, probably it goes back to around about 1999. The General Secretary General at the time of the ILO was Mr. Juan Somabia, who introduced this idea of a term. And it obviously caught on in the ILO internationally. Decent work, as the word suggests, is something nice, we all want it. And it became very quickly a main objective within ILO and its work internationally. And in a nutshell, what's the main goal of the ILO Decent Work Agenda, as they call it, is to, as it says in the slide, to promote opportunities for women and men to obtain decent and productive work in conditions of freedom, equity, security and human dignity. Quite a mouthful, but those are important terms. Decent and productive work in conditions of freedom, equity, security and human dignity. That says that I think it gives an understanding of work as not only something that gives income, but it's also a source of dignity, family stability. It contributes to national economic growth. It's much more than just an individual doing a few tasks from 8 to 5 and taking home a pay packet at the end of the week or the month. This is the ILO's approach. It's a much broader understanding. It's a tall order often in many countries, for many developing countries like ours, but it's just challenges. Then to unpack it a bit further, one can look at decent work as the ILO does in terms of four pillars. There's the concept of what the decent work is, the definition, and then there are four aspects that really, four legs, if you like, that the agenda walks on. Firstly, to promote fundamental principles and rights at work. Number two, to promote employment and income opportunities. Number three, to expand and improve social protection cover. And lastly, to promote social dialogue and tripartism. So those are the four pillars that really give the framework for what the decent work agenda is and what the ILO tries to promote and where it tries to focus its activities around the decent work agenda. So it's not everything to do with the world of work, but it is broad, it is far-reaching, governed by these four strategic pillars. In South Africa, probably for us, the decent work agenda first came to light in the election manifesto in 2009 of the African National Congress, the ruling party, where it said the creation of decent work and sustainable livelihoods was used in the manifesto. And shortly thereafter, in his inaugural State of the Nation, President Zuma again spoke specifically to the creation of decent work being at the center of our economic policies and will influence our investment attraction and job creation initiatives. So from 2009, I think this idea was given center stage within the current government and the ruling party, center stage, be at the center of economic policies. And it was echoed in a new growth path. I don't have to tell you the terms are used, it's not unpacked or defined, but there is talk in the new growth path about decent work being more jobs and better jobs, being at a concrete expression. And certainly, when we started the labor law amendments, also in round about 2009, this was a very important rationale. The issue of dealing with labor broking goes directly to the promotion of principles and rights at work. It goes directly to issues of social protection. The way we amend, obviously, is through social dialogue. So our amendments, you could say, were also picking up in quite a direct way on a decent work agenda. Coming to the second part, what are we doing in South Africa? Well, let me just start and say the ILO has this agenda of decent work to promote it internationally. It's defined it, it's got its pillars, and how it actually works to promote decent work is through what it calls decent work country programs. Country programs. There are about 20 in Africa, there are many more internationally, and it's really a way in which the ILO delivers support to member states. It's a program. It says, we launch this program at a certain time, these will be the priorities, these are the funding allocation for the program, and then let's work. Let's start promoting and creating, improving decent work situations. So the intention of the ILO is definitely to do its work to contribute to national development strategies. And practically, the country programs become a tool to deliver priorities over a defined period. A tool to achieve, if you like, a reduction in our decent work deficit. We started in 2008 with a consultative workshop down here in Milton with labor, business, government departments. We then went into a country situation analysis to look at what is the state of play in South Africa, what should the decent work country program be focusing on, and our former minister, Mr. Mchiplana, launched the program in September 2010, and what he launched was that blue booklet. There was a media segment, and the expression of the decent work country program was captured in that document. Now, what we are trying to do is to complement efforts by government to address its objectives. Obviously, we're not working in isolation. Decent work is the center of government policies. So our work needs to try and complement the work of government and address objectives for all stakeholders to achieve certain decent work imperatives. The locus of the Decent Work Country Program is in the NEDLAC offices in Rosebank. We coordinate it in our department. I'm the coordinator in the department, and we get very good support from the ILO Pretoria office. And then we manage it, as Mr. Kittle has indicated, through a steering committee. I'll come back to that, the governance issues. Now, I mentioned that we've got the four pillars of the Decent Work, the ILO's Decent Work agenda. The country programs obviously have to become programmatic, so we developed a matrix in South Africa with the ILO, with business and labor. We have four priorities and 9 outcomes. This is a bit like a project plan, if you like, to do things around decent work. And I'm going to just give you a sense of what are our priorities, what are the outcomes. I'm not going to read everyone. If you want to take questions, chair, or come back to it, but I think I'll bore you if I go through word for word what's on the screen. But let me just give you a sense of what our priorities are. Number one is to strengthen fundamental principles and rights at work. That goes directly to one of the key pillars. How do we do that? Well, we want to survey what international labor standards have we ratified, how do we comply with them, how do we report on the international labor standards and conventions that we've ratified. That's might seem a fairly obvious thing to do, but we have been having criticism from business and labor that we report to the ILO, they don't see the report, they don't make inputs, they don't form a basis for engagement in NEDLAC. So there's also an element of trying to work towards improving our standards, compliance and reporting in a way that strengthens our relationship with our social partners. Number two, as the department, our labor administration, we want to apply up-to-date labor legislation and provide effective services. So you will see later there's quite a lot of activity in the department where we work with the ILO to strengthen and make our department and its services more effective. The second priority is the ambitious one in promoting employment. And here, let me just take outcome four, sustainable and competitive enterprises, including cooperatives, which we'll come back to in Mr. Murakawa's presentation, create productive and decent jobs, especially among women, youth, and people with disabilities. The groups that are most vulnerable in our labor market. So there's an outcome where activities are conducted, and we have to then try and say at the end of the program what headway we made through this program in promoting sustainable and competitive enterprises. Skills development obviously is another priority under outcome 5. Priority 3, this follows the pillar again of the ILO's pillars of the agenda, strengthening and broadening social protection. In South Africa, we definitely need more people to have access to better managed and more gender equitable social security and health benefits. We're still a bit behind on government's social security reform initiatives, but there are other initiatives taking place, but that obviously would be the big drive that would make a major impact on outcome 6 of the Decent Work Country program. But we also say that the world of work must respond effectively to HIV and the AIDS epidemic. And again, I'll come back to that where there is ongoing work. And then the last priority, strengthening tripartism and social dialogue. The outcome is to strengthen the labor market institutions, to capacitate our social partners. And in South Africa, we talk about tripartite plus, which is not just government, business, and labor, but in the governance structures, we include community constituency in discussions around decent work. And as you will see in the implementation report, a lot of activities are contributing to outcome 9. So that's our metrics, our project plan, if you like, our priorities, the outcome, that's the framework for the South African Country Program. Selected outcome, yeah, thank you. The governance issues, just to touch on that, we have a steering committee which held its first meeting in December 2010, and now meets regularly at NEDLAC. And the purpose of the steering committee is really to have oversight of the formulation, the planning of projects and activities within the framework of the Decent Work Country program. We also approve projects before implementation, and we monitor and review implementation. And that lengthy document, the implementation report, is the document that the ILO tables that we then scrutinize, ask questions, engage with the ILO and other constituencies to see what's actually happening. I should say that this, a small but not unimportant breakthrough, I think, through the steering committee, the Decent Work Country program, is that probably for the first time we're working much more effectively with the ILO office in Pretoria. Quite a few years ago, we did have bilateral engagements occasionally with ILO, but through this program we have a very strong reporting mechanism on what the ILO is doing, not only in South Africa but often in the region. Because remember, the ILO country offices also report to Geneva. They have their own pressures from the head office, but through the country program I'd like to think that we've strengthened our working relationship with the ILO at the local and regional level, and that's certainly been very important, and I think the social partners appreciate that very much. Procedurally, we report through the Labour Market Chamber, NEDLAC, and then through to the Management Committee. The detailed implementation reports, you have an example of the latest one as of the end of April, is presented to each steering committee, and they follow the outcomes and the outputs, and they provide an update to the work program, and it covers, as I said, all the activities of the ILO, Geneva and Pretoria with all social partners. It's not just the ILO that says, we want to create a project in the Free State with funding from the Dutch government to stimulate small enterprises to provide support on the ground. Community also comes and says, we want to engage with the local government in Etiquette. There's a municipality to engage on how to promote street trading and protect the interests of street trading, to promote competitive and sustainable enterprises. They will engage with the ILO, see if they can get technical assistance. It'll become a project, it'll be approved by the steering committee, and it'll be captured in the implementation report. So people are coming from a number of angles to engage with the ILO to have projects that will further their interests and strengthen their constituencies within the framework that we work in. And that's what we look at, and that's what we approve or engage with, make suggestions, etc. Turning to the implementation, I'm just going to want to highlight a few examples. It's from the report, but it also gives you a sense, I hope, of some of the concrete activities that happen under the Decent Work Country program. So if we take the fundamental principles and rights, the output here is the one relevant conventions to the African context are reviewed for ratification, including those relating to labour market governance, gender and social security. In 2012, Cabinet approved that South Africa ratifies the Domestic Work Convention, the Labour Inspection Convention 81, the Maritime Labour Convention, and the Convention on Work in the Fishing Sector. Those, I believe, are all with Parliament. It has been done. It's been ratified. So the next report should be reflecting that it has been completed. Now, that work obviously contributes directly to how we want to work with relevant conventions to strengthen rights and at work and fundamental principles. That's achievement that we've had in the last 2 years. The ILO has also conducted a study on South African social security law and practice to look at the extent of compliance with Convention 102 with social security, and they've been arguing quite strongly that if they look at the UI Act, 90% compliant with Convention 102. There may be a few small things. We could actually also adopt that convention. It's in line with certainly a strong interest by government to have social security reform. So repositioning with ILO technical assistance ourselves to be ready to take the appropriate conventions at the right time when we want to do that. If we take another example in labour administration, how are we actually working with the ILO in the department to strengthen our services and our administration? Well, one critical output is that we want our labour inspection system in the public and private sector to be stronger. And here we've been selected as one of five pilot countries to test the method at harmonising the collection and analysis of inspection data. It's been a big problem in the department. Our inspectors assist and they write handwritten reports that gets consolidated and sent to the head office, but we don't have proper systems to collect information on the inspections. What factories are inspected in what sectors? What are the specific problems? What are the compliance rates? What are issued? Is it undertakings or compliance orders? There's a lot of information that we should be gathering in a much more effective way. So we're working with the ILO to pilot better ways of collecting information. We've also done an in-depth study on the current state and context of stats relating to labour inspection, which also contributes to that, we hope. We want better national capacity to analyse and access data on decent work. Not just what the ILO talks about, but what we think as social partners, together with social partners, what are locally relevant indicators. So I'll come back to this, that we're working on a country profile that we are developing with ILO support, and that's in terms of the country profile, we're doing quite a lot to try and improve information availability on Eastern's work, and we're engaging and negotiating with business and labour and community what is an appropriate indicator. The community, of course, will say that decent work is not just work in the formal sector. There are people working, self-employed people, informal treasures in city centres. That should also be taken on board as under the programme of decent work. Who in this country knows how many informal traders there are in Etiquette selling fruit and vegetables? Very, very few proper information sources available. So if we take that on board, we also have to find a way of actually understanding what can we impact on that sector. So it has implications that are also technical and that pose challenges for us. Employment promotion. This is a big one, and probably there's not enough that's happening. But it's a complicated, it's an expensive area to make inroads. But one of the outputs is to support the upgrading and promotion of social economy enterprises, and that includes co-ops. And here there's some very interesting work, I think. With funds from the Flemish government, we've got a project called the Public Procurement and Social Economy Project in KZN, in the Umkhanyakule district and in Isikweni. And this is just saying, how can we look at provincial government and local government to see where public procurement can stimulate the social economy? So in government, we often go for tree quotes, we look at what providers are on our database. We don't think that actually there could be an informal entity or a small business that's operating that can very well offer catering services to a government function. And so this project is trying to ask tough questions at the provincial and local government level. How are you trying to assist the less advantaged, the less formal operators in areas where you can use their services? Catering can be quite a range of service provision. So if we can find the right method, of course it would mean engaging with Treasury, engaging with procurement regulations, but nothing is achieved without starting somewhere. So this project, I think, is going to be very interesting. And there are others that are also innovating in this way. Social protection. This is the mandatory social security system that we know, we hope the discussion will start at some point. The ILO has worked with our colleagues in the Department of Social Development, looked at how can there be a broad-based national dialogue to define a social protection floor. That's something that the ILO is also promoting very strongly. There was a recommendation adopted last year in the International Labour Conference in Geneva on social protection floors. The unions in this country are very much in favour of a social protection floor. Our National Development Plan makes reference to a very similar idea. So again, our social development is obviously keen to start getting ready for a big discussion in this area. Those are just some examples taken from the implementation report. Let me just jump to examples of, as a department, what concretely do we do? I've mentioned the support for labor administration and inspection services. We've had support for the training of inspectors. A few weeks ago, there was a new module rolled out in the Western Cape to inspectors on training them to, in the light of the conflict in the agricultural sector last year, to better understand freedom of association and collective bargaining, and to incorporate that in their training. So the ILO has developed training material. They've held the first pilot workshop for inspectors in the Western Cape. They've supported labour inspection policy conferences. They've given us assistance to review the code of good practice on HRD8, which we requested. They've supported collective bargaining workshops and many other areas where we, as a department, are directly benefiting. I'd like to just touch briefly on the decent work country profile, because this has relevance to a question I'm sure you're going to ask: what does this all add up to? What's the big picture here? Are we making an impact, really, on our decent work deficit? Well, I'm hoping that the decent work country profile will give us some answers
on where we are as a country in our labor market. It's a subpart of the ILO's decent work agenda. They have their decent work country program. In many countries, the profile is very important because it creates an accurate, objective picture of who's got access to jobs, what are earnings, what are the hours of work, looked at by gender, race, age, etc. So the profile really allows you to interrogate where you stand as a country. And ILO's got quite a big project on supporting decent work country profiles. They've developed a framework of indicators. They've got what they call the MAP project, which is monitoring and assessing progress on decent work. They've launched these projects in Bangladesh, Brazil, Cambodia, Philippines, Zambia. It should be ending this year. And they build information collection systems in countries where there's not good information on areas of decent work. These are the sorts of themes that will be looked at in the profile: employment opportunities, adequate earnings, and productive work. We're still arguing how do we define productive work. So some of us argue any work is productive by definition. You can't work and not be productive. Somehow it doesn't make sense. So what are decent hours? How do we combine work, family, and personal life? These are some of the themes that will be explored and presented in the Decent Work Country Profile, which I should say that we're working on as we speak, and we're aiming to have a workshop in about October to verify the first draft. It will then go to Geneva for publication, and we will certainly be very keen to come back and circulate the country profile, or if required also to present some of the key findings. But let me just end with two slides on the big issue, just to remind us as a country where we stand on decent work. This was a draft that was done towards the profile some months ago. And if we just take employment opportunities, one of the pillars, and we take adequate earnings and productive work, well, in South Africa, currently in our labor market, 34% of people working outside of agriculture, if we exclude agriculture, 34% earn less than two-thirds of a median monthly earning. Median is the midpoint, somewhere around 3,000 rand in South Africa at present. So only about 34% earn less than two-thirds, less than 2,000 rand a month. That tells you something about income and about adequate earning in South Africa. If we look at decent hours, 24%, that's almost a quarter of South Africa's workforce, is working more than 48 hours a week. Who says South African workers are lazy and unproductive? Well, statistics speak for themselves, Chair. Combining work, family, and personal life, that's a tricky one to measure. But what we've said is, let's look at women's work. And we find that women are responsible for 57% of hours spent on work. So, yes? Yeah. Who says women are not working in this country? 57%. I'm sure the chair will elaborate on this. Work that should be abolished, well, about 10%, in my view, is not a major issue, but of those aged between 10 and 17 years are vulnerable on one of the indicators. This is really about child labor, which we cut off at 15. So this indicator still needs some fine-tuning. We're talking 10 to 17. We should, in terms of our laws, be separating our 10 to 15. Equal opportunity and treatment. African men, still for only 14% of top management. African women, 6%. Obvious areas of deficit if we look at equal opportunity. Gender wage gap is about 30%. Safe work environment, I'm afraid we're silent. I must say that here we are struggling with our accident statistics, our compensation statistics for occupational injuries and diseases. We're working on this in a project, but it's a gap. And so our trade union coverage is at 30%. Which is actually not bad by international standards, it's not bad at all, but obviously we would like to have it higher. So thank you. That's just from touching base with what the reality, the profile when it's complete will give a much more systematic picture. And we hope that in time the sort of the many projects and the activities under the Decent Work Country Program can reflect in a small way in some of the statistics we see here. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Silva. Thank you, Honorable Professor and Honorable Member.
I'm going to brief the Select Committee on the Department of Labor's involvement in cooperatives. This is one area that we understand very well. It's something that we know its impact in terms of contribution to employment creation. And I will also outline a number of interventions and initiatives that we're involved in so that the Select Committee can have a broader understanding of DOS involvement in this area. Honorable members will remember that this area, especially until 2009, before a decision was taken to transfer Umsobumbu Youth Fund and skill development to Department of Higher Education and Training and CITAS, this department funded a number of very high-level interventions across all provinces. We had agreements with the provincial governments where we gave them out of the National Skills Fund in the region of 100 million rand each between 2007 and 2009 to promote the concept of cooperatives, because of the understanding that there is saturation. I mean, we can do everything we can in the formal sector to try and create employment, but unless in the deep rural areas we also begin to provide some form of interventions to get people to really assist themselves with the land restitution programs and so on, you are not likely to improve in, you know, in terms of employment creation unless there's some kind of injection and knowledge and skills provided to rural communities. So I want to talk more about those interventions because we're no longer responsible. When the functions were transferred, those functions were also transferred, and with it went millions of resources in terms of rents that we're pumping into this whole process. But secondly, I will talk to the involvement in discussions with DTI, because DTI is the custodian of the Cooperative Act, and those who are familiar with the law is that it actually provides a completely different labor relations dispensation for cooperatives. And thirdly, I will also talk to the research that the LPNIR continue to do on cooperatives. And this was done precisely to say, given the fact that there are challenges with regard to employment creation, what alternatives can we do in this area, and how best can we address some of the emerging problems, and I'll talk to some of them. And lastly, what is it that we continue to do in the labor centers insofar as cooperatives are concerned. So I'll talk briefly on the four areas. Regarding the DTI involvement, we have been having discussions with DTI there were a number of problems. We visited some farms in Limpopo and others in Mpumalanga where there was land restitution processes. And we found a lot of, I mean, in one farm, if I recall, Mr. Kedlas, it was a citrus farm which had just been given to the community. And when we got there, workers were happy that we came with the Minister of Labour, and that their salary issues were going to be sorted out, and their working conditions. Now, the difficulty was that they are the owners. The only problem there was that when the farmer was bought out, he agreed to remain managing the farm for a while as a retainer and as a consultant So you know, there were a whole range of things that we noticed there, and this practice is common in a number of farms. We came across a number of incidences in KZN and Newcastle. Most of the textile employers, without or in some cases with very little knowledge of workers, they convert the company from being owned by 10% to being a cooperative, and workers are meant to be shareholders. So you then find that the labor relations dispensation in those cases no longer apply, because workers are not to be owners when in actual fact they are working, and the salaries they get, in some cases they are told is dividend, and then when the company has not done well, they are told, look, we are owners, and I'm sure members also know about the employer share schemes, etc. But I think the involvement with DTI was to also point out some of the loopholes. There were things that we achieved, but there are some things that we still did not achieve. The Amendment Act came to Parliament and is now, as we understand, waiting for the President's signature. But the degree and extent to which it addresses some of the problems is something that is left to be seen, because that Act also has a number of issues that are creating problems in other areas. The Department conducted a research, and like we said, we understand that, the way the ILO defines cooperatives, I don't have to read, it's a very broad concept of an association of persons united voluntarily to meet their economic, social, cultural needs through a joint owned and democratically controlled enterprise. And that these are an important vehicle that can improve the living and working conditions of women and men globally, as well as making essential infrastructure services available in those areas where governments are not making a lot of investment, or the private sector is not investing. And it has been proven in some countries, and we'll give you a slide that indicates a number of interventions where millions of jobs have been created using cooperatives, and we understand your concerns in this area. And that in South Africa, everyone knows, and the reason why there's also an interest in this area is that cooperatives can also contribute towards poverty reduction, creating employment, and also make sure that young people, including our contribution to Millennium Development Goals, can be achieved. And the research that the department conducted indicates that there's a lot of experience. There's also an understanding on a number of movements and crucial drivers that make cooperatives work or fail. And we've also looked at a number of worker ownership and control. And this is something that is going to catch up with us, especially with employee share schemes and so on. And the extent to which they own shares, what does it mean? We are looking at a number of projects, there's a technical cooperation project that is also going to unfold around understanding the whole concept of worker ownership, especially within the farming communities, and how they can contribute to economic democracy, equality, etc. Our first unit came up with a various types of cooperatives. The cooperatives that are worker owned, workers are producers, the cooperatives that are worker managed, and the cooperatives that are worker supported. Now, in each case, there are difficult there are quite a number of issues that we need to understand around the degree of worker control, especially decision making, and secondly on the ownership. And they've also provided a number of samples of countries where some of the models have been successful, where it has been tried, and so on. And the table gives you a list of all those countries as well. But at the end, I think there's also an understanding that the worker cooperative can contribute at the macro and micro level. At the macro level, they can contribute to our growth, structural transformation, labor market benefits, innovation, etc. And this is where workers start buying big shares using their pension funds and so on. And I think the clothing and textile unions have actually gone a long way in terms of acquiring shares and taking over some of the factories that were in trouble. At the micro level, there are issues around costs, around tools that can be developed, including the transformation of the community. And this just gives you a brief that is a sketch on a range of worker cooperatives that are trade union linked, self-development, where people come together, take over, and those that are seeded, where other the owners decide to give over their ownership. Now, from the research that was conducted, they also indicated a number of constraints, both internal and external. The challenges that each of the cooperatives face, because we can't just say these are cooperatives and then come up with assumptions that they all face similar problems and challenges. There are conditions around regeneration. Basically, how do you keep those cooperatives going, growing, and being able to solve a range of problems that they come across, and obviously the decision making and control. There are a number of farms in Limpopo. I'm sure it's the same in a number of other provinces, where after restitution of land, you find big farms with all types of trees and so on, irrigation, etc. Now, if these farms are not properly managed, and you find that 1% comes in their own truck, sell and pocket the money and not bring it to the central point, it leads to the collapse of some of the farms, and that is why the Department of Agriculture and Rural Development currently is reviewing some of the support that is being provided, because some of the farms have been run down as a result of either improper support provided in there. And the whole question of the degeneration. The issue around regulatory standards to prevent abuse of worker model is something that we talked about, that we're taking up with DTI, because certainly in some textile industries, the convention is used to basically exploit workers. They are owners, yet they are not aware of the ownership, or in some cases, workers would come in in their understanding that they are working only to be told, no, you are part of a co-op, and therefore you can earn an income. And inspectors normally when they go to such farms, they have challenges as to how to deal with situations of that nature, because if if the same worker is complaining, is the owner of the farm, when you serve notices and all that, who are you serving those notices against and all that? We also looked at, they also came up with a number of pillars that they proposed that we are currently looking at. And those pillars range from information and technical support. Now, under information and technical support, there are issues ranging from cooperative development advice, turnaround and expansion, etc. This is what the productivity SA is doing in most cases, to make sure that they are able to get rid of wastage and cut down on a number of production processes that result in a lot of wastage and reduce wastage in some areas, etc. And also make sure that where you have incubation, you are able to hold their hands beyond a certain point, and that they are able to take over. A lot of experience was gained under the Umsobomvu cooperative, because where loans were granted and incubation did not go beyond a year, almost half of those cooperatives failed within the next 2 years after the withdrawal of the incubation. So there is a need to actually provide a long-term kind of support to cooperatives if you are to make them to survive. The legislative and regulatory support talks to issues around administration, registration, inspection, issues that we have talked about on the DTI legislation and the education on the Act and the compliance aspect. Pillar 3 on harnessing intergovernmental and non-governmental support, again, it has to do with the technical support coordination and partnerships that must be established. On Pillar 4 that they are proposing, mainly this has to deal with the capital inflow, capital management, and sourcing of those funding, banking, all those, that is the financial management aspect of the cooperative. And the knowledge production and diffusion is basically about, that continuous education to make sure that those cooperatives can survive. Now, our research unit came up with all these recommendations and gave them to Public Employment Services to say, look, we have done research for you and it's up to you to take the processes forward. Now, what we are currently doing, there's a difference between what we are doing now and what we intend doing once the Employment Services Bill becomes law. At the moment, what is happening in a range of labor centers is that our career counselors do provide information on what cooperatives intend to those work seekers who want to venture into this area. This is part and parcel of soft skills that we provide around SMEs, around further learning and so on. We also provide information on types of products and services that cooperatives can intake, and we have a network of partnerships with a range of these cooperatives that gives us information, SANAC and so on, so that young people that want to venture into this area and can be linked to such intervention. We also provide information on where they can get additional information, funding, and so on, because as part of implement services, and there's also an element of assisting them in terms of providing business case for them to can apply for funding from a number of agencies that provide assistance in this area. Going forward, we are continuing to strengthen our networks and partnerships with a range of organizations involved in cooperatives, NYGA, DTI, SANACO, and so on. And basically, this is intended to make sure that the large number of work seekers that we have on the database of the department on ELSA that we find difficult to place in existing jobs, we can channel them into areas such as this one as an alternative way of making a living. And secondly, we are looking at how best to implement some of the research outcomes that colleagues in the LPNIR have actually conducted. And we are currently in a process of establishing a number of pilot schemes. There are proposals coming from each province. Our intention is to have a minimum of 2 pilots per province, and we have now received proposals. Our initial target was to cap them to R1 billion, and the pilots total about R1.4 billion. We are talking to the UIF, the National Skill Fund, and the Job Creation Fund under National Treasury, because we believe that through the employment scheme, and most of the employment schemes have as one of their objectives is that even if the scheme can last, for instance, a year, 6 months, up to 3 years or so, it must have exit strategies. Now, exit strategies, they include formal employment, may include SMEs, and may include also cooperatives. And this is what we intend piloting from the second quarter and beginning of next year, depending on whether we will be able to raise the applicable funding. But currently, signs are that the UIF board is keen to get involved into this pilot. So, Honorable Chairperson, that's how far we can say we are involved in so far as cooperatives are concerned. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the informative presentation on different work, ILO and the cooperatives. Members, I'll give this opportunity to you now to ask questions, comments, and so forth. Honorable Mlenzana, followed by Honorable Dacox. In that order, others will indicate to me if they want to say something. I think it's so clear that today Honorable Kroneval doesn't want to say a thing.
You'll be surprised. Yeah, you work hard for it. Not very easy. Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you also to the department for the presentation. On a more serious, Chairperson note, this presentation is more educational making us as a step committee more clearer than we thought we knew. As far as both topics are concerned. On cooperatives, I've got one question, Chair, but it's intertwined. There is this slide, Understanding the Worker Cooperative Advantage. I'm not sure of Understanding the cooperative advantage five. Because we have bullets they're talking about degeneration which can be avoided. Yeah,
That's the word. I listened to Mr. Murtova when he is talking outside slide on some of the causes of such degeneration. But now, me, I'm looking at this powerful definition of a co-op, you know. I was saying to Honorable Basti, it's loaded. It's taking me back, Mr. Karya, to where I come from. I won. But it's taking me back, that definition. But now,
you're welcome.
Sure. But now, looking at that definition, linked with your slide, I think it's the second last slide, your slide 10-7. Yes. That slide, Chairperson, also, that is for an already, for a group of individuals or persons who are already ready to establish a co-op. That's my view. But now, going back to that definition, you are saying it's very loaded. Co-ops are defined as autonomous association of persons. I like that clause, united voluntarily, to meet their economic, social, and cultural needs. But now, the degeneration where I started is usually as a result of a situation where, in the South African context, in a majority of cases, you notice that these cooperatives do not grow on their own, where these individuals are persons who understand each other, the mindset, the feelings, and all such, before they decide that let's form the cooperative. There's nowhere where their unity has been tended. The question of these young ones who have been together excuse me, at school, and they can see that they are now jobless, and then they just decide, let's not form a co-op. Only to find that even their backgrounds are totally, totally different. Hence, once money is pumped in for them to start the co-op, it's caused a bad wound. There's literally no profit. They tell the very first capital, and they make up the whole thing. They are out of debt. They fight among each other. Why? Because that unity that you spoke about was not tested. So I was now checking, is there no way of assessing the level of understanding amongst and unity between the persons intended to establish a cause? Just perhaps say if it would have a pager wherein, as if we say, yes, we want to establish a co-op, then either as individuals or and both as a group, they are given some questionnaire, which would begin to assess them, check them. Do you know this person? For how long are you able to handle his or her anger and what have you? Because in a majority of cases, it's people who literally do not trust each other. Thanks, Chair President.
Thank you. Jacob?
Yeah, thanks, Chair. And also, thanks for the presentation. Chair, what I'm going to raise, I don't know how to formulate it. You know, it's going to be abstract. I don't want something as a foreign. So if you ask the question, that should be practical. Because I think I'm going to theorize. I don't want to theorize. Maybe the background where I come from. Theory and then it must be practice. So if it is just theory, it doesn't work. Okay, we are talking about decent jobs. But it is even difficult to have a job. But we are talking about a decent job. And now, the Department of Labor, when they have inspections, they come across people who are doing business informally. And now, what do they do when they find that here is a person having a business which is informal and does not meet the standards of decent jobs? Do they come up with punitive measures or do they come up with corrective measures? With corrective measures, I mean to say, here is a person who started a business, but these are challenges that we found in this business. How do we help him to succeed in this business? And also maybe to refer him to other institutions where he can get help, so that he should move from an informal business to a formal business. So how do you come in? That's why I'm saying these things, I don't want people. Secondly, you're talking about cooperatives. Cooperatives, that's unfortunate. I've seen the little research in countries where they're having cooperatives. Maybe if it was not late, maybe we could have visited one or two of these countries just to check on this. How do they work? No, it's late. Our focus now is on elections. You remember he was campaigning in our debate last time, so there's no time for oversight views. For election year. On this issue of cooperatives, it goes back to what I said with informal business. They say after a year of incubation, they collapse. And also, in your employment counseling, there are many points that you have put here. How they have to operate. The first one is say, obtain additional information assistance on cooperatives. I'm just thinking, you say, you go there, you get assistance. You go there, you go assistance. But as we know, the environment in which we are working, people will always, they are always looking for kickbacks, to assist somebody. They'll say, you give me something, or you'll only assist that if you are well connected. And now, are we going to achieve these objectives that we want to set ourselves in? And how do we try to assist? Because I think it's important, even that thing of incubation, just abruptly leaving those people without even understanding the kind of business that they are doing. Because I think it must be a systematic withdrawal, not just abruptly. I don't think for years is enough. So it means maybe 3 years to 5 years to see at least that these people have moved from informal business to a formal business successfully. So that where those people live, that business must be able to sustain itself. So that's why I'm saying what I'm talking here is it's a lot of theory and abstract. I don't know how can we assist in this what I'm trying to raise. Because it is quite clear jobs are not being created. The only way to create jobs, it is for people to create their own jobs, and that results in informal jobs. So it means you need to get an experience from informal jobs until you have a formal job. So in that manner, I think we can go where we want to that we can reach the destination that we want to go to. Thank you.
No, thank you very much. You know, I don't know whether I should be excited with the presentation or should I be obsessed with it. And I'll tell you why. Because, you know, for some of us, we had to feel the heat when we started even, you know, there was a time in this country, just to mention the word cooperative, it was a taboo, you know, it was a taboo. And, you know, for 2009, for the manifesto of the ANC, it was, you know, clearly spelled out to say that one of the issues that we're going to do is to focus as part of broadening the participation in the economy would also be to focus on not only building cooperatives but strengthening cooperatives, making them a strategic instrument of job creation and growing the economy alongside your SMEs and so forth. I mean, it is known now that the informal economy contributes almost more than 70%. of economic activity globally. I do not have the exact statistics in the country on the extent to which your SMEs have contributed towards the GDP and so forth. I don't have it now with me, and I don't want to unpack. But what disappoints me, Che, is the extent to which we took time to be where we are. For us to have realized, you know, I want to take from the definition as identified by Honorable Mlenza, your United Voluntary to Meet Economic. And that economic is not that much to me. What comes quite central is your second part, social and cultural needs to joint ownership. Because that education would then speak to the issues that Honorable Mlenza speaks to, that cultural aspect. Because whether we like it or not, cooperatives are, by their nature, I mean, it has got an ideological posture. It doesn't matter, it has an ideological posture. the social unity that we're talking about, economic social cohesion, that we're talking about, it's underpinned by clearly defined ideological principles. And if that is not inculcated, or is not even brought to the fore, to those that we seek to bring in and unite, they're bound to be. There's no way that they're going to achieve. So that education is very, very much central and important to the establishment of cooperatives. I was just looking at the number of co-ops that we have. KwaZulu-Natal is more than 11,000 counting. Okay, of course, others were created under the old act, which did not in the main address the issues that we want to achieve. So that transition was also quite important. I'm looking at my progress. Hey, well, my wife, I understand. 7 out of 9. It would be good even if I can know where these co-ops are. You know, are they agricultural co-ops? Are they whatever? What form are they? You know, we might not get information now, but it would have been good. So that if there are co-ops that are registered, that are sponsored in my constituency, I must go and workshop them. I must go and work with them. It must be part of my responsibility to assist them to grow. But if I wouldn't know, I would really love if we can be furnished with such information that will point to where these cooperatives are. What is the status now of them? Where are they? Are they still functional?
Are they living up to the objectives that they're supposed to? The third aspect, now that the presentation is given, it's quite clear that also it would be unfair even to point fingers at the Department of Labor, whether it be on the successes or growth of the corps without having TTI. I was asking one of them, Lenzan, as we were walking in, say, hey man, just 2 weeks ago we passed an amendment in the House, and that amendment was led by the Minister of Trade and Industry on cooperatives. How do we link these two things? How do we bring these two departments together so that the other one is able to speak to the other? Because even when you speak of co-ops, you can't pinpoint it to a single department. You find agriculture also talking about their support to cooperatives. In provinces, it's led by the Department of Economic Development and Tourism in provinces, where you do not have a concurrent Department of Labor. You know, where do these departments report? Do they report to the Department of Labor, or do they report to the Department of Economic Development or Trade and Industry? So at the level of coordination as well, it is quite worrying to say, how then do we as provinces really work towards the coordination? And in some instances also, where you find provinces that are not clustered, you find finance is not clustered with economic development. And then you have economic development being your custodian cooperatives. The funding comes from Pedro, province. And Pedro province would not be able to tell you exactly how it links up with economic development insofar as monitoring is concerned. So it really creates a lot of confusion in our own provinces, even when we have to do oversight on co-ops and so forth. But I'm happy with this aspect of this, the farms. You know, not only in KwaZulu-Natal, in all our provinces, we're having that experience. I can tell you, the Free State, wherever we have taken parliament to, as the NCOB, part of the agricultural oversight that we've done, we have come across such problems. Where our people, the Department of Agriculture having bought land to them, given over, they say they are a co-op, but at the same time, they will be demanding payment from somebody else because they believe that person is their owner. But it's fine paper. If you see the certificate, yes, no. We own this one, but we are not paid. So, it's a national problem that day, and I don't know how we're going to resolve it. And then some of these people, they do take advantage of our people, the ignorance on the part of our people. They do take advantage of them, and abuse that area. So, I agree entirely that it was not an eye-opening presentation, which then brings a lot of questions, more than any other thing. Maybe at some point, I don't know whether Honorable Jacobs, if we have time during these last couple of months to do this work, you know, where we can have economic development, ETI, labor, DTI in particular, because then DTI will give us an eagle eye kind of presentation to this. This is where we are. This is how the legislation is going to be implemented. These are the monitoring mechanisms. This is support that we would need from the Department of Labor, whether it be agriculture or whatever. This is how we're going to work together to ensure that we achieve. The expanded public works, for instance, part of the expanded public works as it was introduced in the previous administration was also to then have an entry point of these young people who will be taught skills. But at an exit point, it will then be coordinated in co-ops and all the sorts of income maintenance, or whether it be roads, whether it be what, but that collective effort, you know, will be there to grow them as young people who have been skilled
through the short-term job opportunities that we have created. So I think I might just say thank you very much. It was quite eye-opening. I know I'm one of the people that has been very consistent in saying the issue of cost. I'm just briefing it. It's really quite clear. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable President. I think Honorable Dawu, I think that the House Chair, you remember, you said committees must choose, you know. Yes, so that we know that we have worked on this and we've got, you know, at the end of the day, we've got information and we see the difference in what we are doing. And I think we are online.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yeah, from my side, thank you very much for the presentation. It was quite interesting for me to listen to you and see how things are working and is getting together at the end of the day. But the most important part for me in this presentation is priority number 2, outcome 3, 4, and 5. I think that is the way we have the most, and the other speakers already talk a lot about it, but for me, that is the crux of everything. And the role the department is playing in these situations, and that is, if we're looking into it, the sustainable and competitive enterprises, including the cooperatives, that is really playing a big role, because if I'm listening to the other speakers and members, that is, I have the very same situation in the Northwest province as well. The same problems other provinces have with oversight versus people who get farmed. They are unskilled. They haven't got the skill, and they do not know how to manage it. And most of the time in all these projects are 10 or more people in such a project. And after a couple of months, the money is gone, and the people start fighting. And that is all about skills. And the most of these people who is in these cooperatives are older people. It's people who are staying on a farm or in a situation, and they grow up in it, and then they think, but if they get the land and they've got the equipment, they can start with a fell, I do not know if you name it a fell farm or a vegetable garden or something like that, but that is not sustainable. When the money is gone, they wait for the department again to supply them with money and with the seats and everything, and then they start all over. So there's no progress in such a situation. And I think that is where the Department of Labor has a big role to play. And I also want to know, we talk a lot about the national economic development. What role are you really play there? What contribution are you making from your side as department, the new and national development plan? I think that is where we can create jobs, where we can stop skilled people, because the money is available. Now we must just get the people there and train them and put them in a situation where they can start as an entrepreneur, and as time is going, you can get a qualified person on a certain situation. I think that's the way we must move. Maybe you already done it, but if you can tell us a bit more about that, I'll appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I was asked by this, the issue, the concept of decent work. My understanding, the issue of the concept of decent work is about promotion of fundamental principles and rights at work that relate to, and also to the promotion of employment and income opportunities, etc. So now, I've got the worry, like I said, that I believe that in order for you to have the country's profile, you must have a data on employment. Therefore, my question would be, is the department have the data of the unemployment in South Africa? Because there are two things now which are talking about. There is the issue of co-ops. Of course, we do have a data of co-ops of which is also worrying me. Out of the population of South Africa, about 40-something million, but the data indicates that the only registered people are plus minus 40,000. They don't receive even 500,000. That's my worry. Therefore, you see, again, does this information enable the department to comply with its concept of the defense work? And then again, what is worrying me, my colleagues have spoke about a lot of, about cooperatives. I'll put an example. So person, my concern is that, do you still remember when during the program of taking Parliament to the people, when we visited Mpumalanga in Carolina, we went to a certain project, April project, right there between Volcast and Mello. What we discovered there, some of the officials, they don't go practically to that practically area to do a proper monitoring. Because we were told about we saw the project of April, they included the issue of cows. Only to discover that these people, it's their own arrangement, it's not the department's arrangement. So, what is worrying me? Do you have a proper monitoring mechanism in that regard, in terms of your co-ops? Because if we don't have any proper mechanism of monitoring, that's where we have a problem. And then also, you see, there was a thing which was raised by my colleagues about the issue of stakeholders, like a department of, in terms of co-ops, Department of Agriculture, Department of DTI, etc. Now, what I wanted to find out, because that is the problem, if we wanted to reach a goal, our systems must talk to each other in terms of coordination. Is your system talking to each other? That's where is the problem. And then again, this one, ma'am, I brought it to that. But I wanted maybe a further elaboration of this one. What is the relationship between the WPs and with your co-ops? And then again, you see, when you talk about economics, what is worrying me about the issue between on page 30 on your presentation about the issue of macroeconomics and microeconomics? Yes, you are right to say co-ops, they fall under the category of microeconomics. But you see, my worry, we can have good initiatives, but as long we don't have made proper guidance in terms of how to make these microeconomics to sustain themselves, our own initiatives and thinking is mistaken. I mean, it will fall apart. In which sense, the key fundamental question which we must ask ourselves is that what caused all this microeconomics, to be dysfunctional? Because on my understanding, there are two key fundamental questions also. Number one, if they are not skilled enough, will give the right person, the former owner, to run the project. At the end, the majority of money goes to him. Or else, they call it the mentor. They will hire a mentor. And then the budget doesn't go to the real project. The budget goes to the mentor to pay the mentor. These are some of the challenges which we are facing. And then I want you to find out from your own that I'm searching for corrections. We have signed a lot of conventions in terms of the ILO. Are we complying with some of these conventions? Because you mean it doesn't, if we're not complying, it means that there's no progress. Just signing, but we don't comply. And then another thing which is worrying me, you see, I'm from Mpumalanga province. In Mpumalanga province, part of the challenges we are facing is issue of seasonal labor. what is the department doing in terms of that regard? Because to me, it disadvantages some of the people if we allow a situation to continuously of using people from outside the country in terms of seasonal labor. I don't have any problem with seasonal labor per se, but I do have a problem with the terms of the people who are being employed to come and work, because they do take people from outside the country. It is nice that they take people from outside the country, of which I don't think that they comply with some of the protocols which we have signed. And then also, which is painful then, the issue of labor brokers is continuing to form, which is having also a negative impact to us. Because I don't remember even a single day they comply. And also, which is going to empower the parliamentarians or also whatever, is to have a data. How many labor brokers do we have in the country? Because if we take with assumption, it will be very difficult. You find, for an example, like my best friend is having a labor broker somewhere, when it's a labor broker, I go and collect monies without being detected. But if labor does have the data in that regard as well, it can assist a lot. Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you, Honorable Sivande. Honorable sir, when you do this, I see maybe I understand you want to say something. You see, I know you. Can you speak to my cop, Honorable Sivande?
No, thank you. I was reminded by Honorable Sivande around the issue of the labor broadcast. Can I just quickly check on whether the department is really comfortable? I know there is a problem. There's a lot of debate whether we should abolish or should scrap them or we should regulate them. You know, it's another debate. That will be sorted out. It's fine. COSATU is in a central executive committee now. We would hear what they come up with after. But I'm interested on what is decent work agenda. I forgot this one earlier. And you say to promote opportunities for women and men to obtain decent and productive work in conditions of freedom, equity, security, and human dignity, in particular human dignity. Would you still agree that, as a department, that labor brokers provide what we define as decent work, insofar as this definition is concerned? Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable
Dawu,
Honorable
Dekho. Yeah, Chair. Oliver, I just forgot one thing. On the issue of cooperative, do people understand what is a cooperative? Because some of the people, they say it's a cooperative, but the way they run it like a private company. So do they understand the two concepts?
Thank you. Mr. Martin, when you were presenting on the ILO, the decent work, when we spoke of 57% that women contribute, I really wanted to elaborate on that, to say, I don't even think the 57% is the correct percentage. I wanted my colleagues to understand that women contribute more than that. While I start at home, preparing for the kids to go to school as a woman. After I've done that, then I prepare for my partner to go to work, then prepare for myself. And then we all go to work. And then when we come back at work, I've got my own responsibilities at work. And then when we come back, that thing still happens. Even for those that I say, maybe I say I'm a gender activist, I want my colleagues and men around this table to understand what women are. And when I come at home, I start by preparing dinner. Even before dinner, nowadays there are some men who are now adding to, you know. Yeah, they expect the children at school, but after fetching children at school, there are a few of them who will peel a potato. even cooking, there are a few of them, and I appreciate that there are those. But this is a lesson that we must all along, you know, try to talk about it, so that all those who don't understand that women contribute many percentage understand that. And I would really ask my colleagues to, in their constituencies, to have workshops of such nature and invite the Department of Labor and also myself. I'll volunteer to come to those workshops because that is an issue next to my heart. And so that we all stop reading newspapers as men.
And laptops.
And laptops, iPads, you name them. And watch TV, the news. You know, men understand the news, what is in the news, more than the woman. Because the woman gets this when she will debate that at a later stage. I just wanted to say just a little bit of it.
If you are telling now, the majority of men.
So this one, I think, is equality. This one is equality, you know, Parliament has realized, let's say the ruling party also has realized that we've got to share the responsibility. So congratulations to the ruling party. And then, Honorable Mr. Mansoor, there is this, you mentioned a point of saying the communities says, the community says they don't see the report from ILO. I don't know whether I captured you correctly, but this is something that we usually talk about and say, when we come back from ILO, we've got even the IPU, international conferences, do we have a mechanism of going to people, to municipalities, to rural areas and tell them about the international law that, you know, or conferences and reports that we gathered from those conferences, the reports that we gathered from conferences when we are outside the country. But, when we were talking, I understood that somehow, somewhere, you do that, but we would want you to actually go deeper. You said you started the consultation in Milnerton in 2008. But I would like to see you going to rural areas. We got them in all the provinces. So that when I stand in the chamber and talk about the Convention on Domestic Workers, then a person in Godin, in Kwamhlushwa, understand what we are talking about. And then also, I think if the activity by labor brokers that seem to work against the concept of different workers being addressed on the labor through the Labor Relations Amendment Bill, I think we will rest if they are being addressed. The bill is still there, right? It hasn't come to us. We will see when it comes to us. And also the department needs to urgently actually address the challenges facing the inspectorate services because this inspectorate enforcement services forms a vital part of this network. So if you can address the challenges facing this inspectorate, you'll come to the rescue of this network. And then on slide 8, I noted that you do monitor and review the implementation of decent work program, but do you have specific time frames and targets, for example, on quarterly basis where you say this is your performance against your target, specifically on women, youth and people with disabilities? And We've got these people you spoke about, them, Mr. Mansoon. These women who sit like on the, they are there also in Hazyview, who sells the fruit, vegetables, and the crop. How often does this department check on those people? Do you have the list of how many people are doing that kind of business, and how do you assist them? Because I would tell you, and I think this is the issue that the department must take it up. If you go to Hazyview, there are women there. Some are underneath the, what do you call it? Yes, but there are some who are not underneath there. And they are fighting, you see, and it seems there is Market, yes. So if maybe you can talk to your counterparts in Mpumalanga, in Hazyview, to go and check really what is happening there, because something funny is happening there. Thank you, and if after you have worked on the profile, I see you have a draft. If you have it, can we share that one with us as the committee also? And what Honorable Tau has requested, if you can send us the list of cops per province. And I understand that all of us here, when we draft our programs for constituency work, we will put this in our program, and we will come and share with you what we have found. Thank you, and over to you, Mr. Mansoon, followed by Mr. Marutuvain. Oh, are you starting, Mr. Kendler?
Yes.
Okay,
thank you. I'll start with the easy one. I leave the difficult ones to them. On the issue of the Honorable Sibanda raised around, do we have data on employment? We do, through the labor force surveys. I will start with the quarter one in 2030, which was released the 6th of May at the time. There's a breakdown even by province. In quarter one, for Limpopo, it was 20.3%, KwaZulu-Natal 21.1%, Western Cape 23.3%, the whole of the country, you know, the unemployment figure is 25.2% nationally. For Gauteng is 25.2, for Northwest 26.5, Mpumalanga 29.4, Northern Cape 29.6, Eastern Cape 30.2, that's the second highest, and then Free State, unfortunately, is 31.6. Now, Honorable Jacobs has left. So nationally it is 25.2, and we have the comparative figures for quarter four of 2012 and quarter one of 2012. So it's tracked by quarter, so we are able to track that. It's also tracked by gender, by education, and so on. So there's lots of information available through the quarterly labor force survey. On unemployment figures. Secondly, the issue of conventions. The conventions that Parliament has just ratified recently, when we propose ratification of a convention, it is preceded by a process where we look at whether we would be in compliance with such a convention. Because we do have to submit reports to the ILO annually on the application of conventions in our labor market or in our world of work. We then, after having submitted those reports to the ILO, we then get either an observation from the committee of experts that look at these reports, or we get direct requests for additional information. So as far as the reporting process has gone, we have not had
a situation where the ILO Committee of Experts say to us that you are completely out of sync with these conventions. I want to use the example of the employment equity legislation. When we have ratified the discrimination conventions, Convention 100 and Convention 138, Convention 100 and Convention 111, we have ratified those. When, and then we have given effect to those issues through the employment equity legislation. When we reported on the employment equity legislation, the ILO Committee of Experts then said to us, but your law does not explicitly provide for the principle of equal pay for work of equal value. They suggest that we amend the law so that there is explicit provision for that in the law. That is why that law is now before Parliament for that amendment. So we are improving that provision in the law. We have said to the ILO, no, we comply, we have a provision. They say, no, but it's not explicit enough, so you must strengthen it. So that is why we're making the amendment. So generally speaking, we are complying with the conventions. And in fact, with Convention 81, the inspection one, and as indicated with Convention 102, which we have not ratified, the ILO had a workshop with us on the issue of Convention 102 to determine whether or not we would be in a position to ratify that convention, given our law, our practice, and our policies around Social Security. So now we would come forward and say, let's ratify the convention because the ILO believes that we would be in compliance with that. We did a similar exercise on convention, or the labor inspection conventions with the ILO. There was a workshop in 2011 conducted by the ILO, where they then did a gap analysis between what the conventions, the inspection conventions say, and what our legislation and policies and practices are. And based on their gap analysis, the recommendation was then that we are in compliance with the inspection convention, and therefore we can ratify it. And it's on that basis that we have then brought Convention 81 on labor inspection to Parliament, that we are comfortable now, the ILO is comfortable that we can comply. But we still have to report as and when the ILO requires us to report on the application of that convention, we must still submit reports on how we are implementing it. And they send us a questionnaire that we must then complete on how we are implementing the convention. This year we are doing 5 conventions where there's a process now in motion where questionnaires are being completed, and again we'll then submit those reports to the ILO. So there's no problem of compliance with the conventions, and when we bring them to Parliament for ratification, we believe we are already in a state where we can ratify it. Similarly with the Convention on Domestic Work, same thing, we've gone through that, we've gone through the work in the fishing sector, similar processes we have gone through. On the issue of foreign labor, Mr. Morozova may also talk about that, and the issue of migration, but the principle is always that where an employer wants to employ foreign labor, there is a process that they must go through. They must apply for a work permit. The Department of Labor is consulted about whether or not that permit should be granted. And the criteria for us is that if the labor that is requested for is available in the country, then the permit is declined. The application for the recommendation to Home Affairs is to decline the application. But where the skills are not available, then of course you can then grant permits, but permits should also be granted with conditions. Sometimes some of the conditions are, especially where it is skilled people, that there should be transfer of skills. Or it is granted for a defined period of time, not forever. Like in Limpopo, those people working on the farms, their permits were for periods of like 6 months in some cases and 12 months in other cases. Then they must return to their country of origin, or there might be a new application for a renewal of the permit. But it then follows the same procedure again to see whether the post that they want people to be placed in have been advertised, what the response was to the advert, but also to look at the Department of Labor's work seekers database to see whether those skills are not already listed by work seekers. So those procedures are going through. And then in terms of conditions of employment, there is no distinction in our law to say that a foreign worker must be paid differently from what local workers are being paid. So if the farm worker's wage is 1,500 rand per month, that will apply to both local people and foreign people. And where our taxes then visit those farms, they must then ensure that there is no underpayment of wages to foreign workers. And where they do find that, then the farmer will have to correct that and pay the wages that has been underpaid. So those that is in regard to the employment of foreign labour. The labour broking issue,
that's a live one,
Parliament. Yes.
On a lighter note, you know, the reason why Orlando Pirates could not defend the title is because of the striker that they have identified could not get a work permit. The Pirates could not work.
But I'm sure in the Northern Cape there are players that could also have filled that position. Chairperson, the labour broking issue, it is before Parliament now. It is one of the contentious issues that the committee is still grappling with. I'm sure that when the bill has gone through the National Assembly, comes to the NCOP, and perhaps some of the issues raised could be further taken forward around how many labour brokers there are in the country and so on. Is there data about them and so on? I think I'll stop there, and then Mr. Muratova will deal with the cooperatives issues, and Mr. Matsoon with the decent work issues. Matsoon, some say Maku. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thanks, Honourable Chairperson and Mr. Gittelberg. Again, I think the point that Honourable Gittelberg was raising around ensuring some kind of unity, education, assessing levels of commitment among co-ops, I think these were some of the things that we battled and struggled with 2005 to 2007 before we actually provided a framework that we used as a basis of funding organizations to train communities to establish co-ops, because we had to make sure that some of these elements are built in. Now, the difficulty, like we said, is that whilst the system was reaching its maturity, at the time, 2008-2009, a decision that was beyond our control was taken, which resulted in the transfer. Now, the only thing that we continue to do is to liaise with the Department of Higher Education and Training. Obviously, the focus may be slightly different to what we had to take some of the things on board, but it's very difficult to impose on them to say, you know, this is this thing has this strategic importance, and therefore you have to do it this way. You can only advise in the structures that were afforded an opportunity to participate in. The reality is that the vehicle, including the resources that we had, both through UNSOM's fund when it was under the Department, CITA and the NSF, currently we no longer have those, and they're somewhere else. And I'm sure from the proposal that Honorable Dawa was suggesting, it may be important for the LEC committee to consider, and unfortunately it makes the size of the team that should be somewhat to be big, because cooperatives is run from everywhere. Mm-hmm. And to get from the Department of Higher Education and Training, their sense
of the kind of education both at FET and higher education institutions, that is the kind of approach that is being adopted to ensure cohesion and unity and all that. Because it's cooperatives are, like we said, everybody is doing something. I must say, Honorable Dam, you summarized a lot of points that actually relate to a number of questions. The issue is that the Cooperatives Act provides its own labor relations dispensation for people working in co-ops, but it's in the Department of Trade and Industry. And we get drawn in because workers working in that environment look at workers in factories and other areas protected under the health and safety, enjoying basic conditions of employment. And they say, but we are not getting all those things. And you are the Department of Labor now. How come the other things are not in practice here? And that's when you go in and you realize that there are problems in the way in which the cooperatives run. And consistently, we've been engaging DTI to say, look, in some instances, what you are starting as a noble intervention is having unintended consequences in other areas. I mean, you take the issue of closing employer training for it to be a co-op. That's a device that is being used to register the company in order to intend exploit workers when they don't even know that they are co-ops. Now you only get to, our inspectors will only get to know that this factory is a co-op when we go through a series of checks and then looking at records and DTI. We don't keep a database of all the co-ops registered. We live with DTI. These are things that we do to try and influence certain policy decisions. I mean, we have clusters in government where one department would come up with a policy proposal. But I think the reason why we have clusters is to try and sensitize other people to understand some of the unintended consequences that may result from their policy intervention on the labor market side unless certain things are addressed. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. But then it's only when those things happen that the fingerprint team starts. And I'm sure honorable members, you know legislation, accountability, etc. And in this case, the Cooperatives Act is under the Department of Trade and Industry. We only interact on committees and so on, as we were invited. I think that the number of unemployed people, we have the 40,000 maybe that was mentioned was a figure that talked to the doctors. Currently the database stands at 1.5 million. We know and we are trying to make sure that we target a lot of people that are unemployed so that we know who they are. And I think there are challenges here in that as much as we are doing all the reach out campaigns to get people to register, there are things that we have identified like incentives. What is the incentive for people to be registered and what are the punitive measures if people are not on the database? Now some of those things are some of things that contribute towards either not everybody who is unemployed coming to register, because in some countries you have got punitive measures and we have been as part of the new bill, employment services bill, you mentioned the question of time that it took. When the transfer happened in 2009, one of the assignments that the president instructed us to do was to create two separate legislation. We started as early as 2009, where in 2013 the bill is still in the National Assembly.
and we have gone through a number of provinces, bill consultations after the consultation, etc. There are certain things that we want to do under the bill, but without the legislative money.
That one, We've gone to provinces.
We consulted in all the bills. We conducted workshops. We have stakeholder workshops. We produced new versions, and we've actually went all out to conduct workshops to get people to understand the implications of a bill. There is no province that we did not go on the four bills that are currently before Parliament. But it has taken time, and we are still, it has, up to now, it has not, I mean, they have not come to the select committee. They are still in the National Assembly. And we're just crossing our fingers because we have lost a lot of time in the process. Briefly on the relationship with EPWP, normally they do register opportunities with us, and as part of the database, people that have the kind of skills that are needed in some of the programs, or those people that do not necessarily have skills that can enable them to be placed in other industries, we do refer a lot of people to EPWP, rural development, the defense force, etc. And in the department, after registering people, we do an assessment of those people. They secretary that we use to assess their competencies, and we group them in different areas, and then we assist them in the interview, etc. And when companies look for people, we do refer them, and that's in the main how we work with EPWP on a range of others. There was a question around clarifying what slide 30 meant on macro and micro. Maybe it may be the way I read it. But the point was to say there are macro, that is high level benefits for weather cooperatives, and there are also certain lower level benefits for cooperatives that are established at different levels. For instance, at macro level, if workers were to use their pension funds like in other areas when the company is under threat to buy out an employer and to own it, in other countries, there are models that have been used that indicated that there has been some level of success in terms of those. Obviously, the risk is in the unity, the democracy, the management, and all that. And small team or at a small scale, obviously, when people manage together, we have seen it with farms. In small areas would have a lot of fresh produce, but they opt to transport their fresh produce from some rural areas to markets where they can access selling of grain and so on. Because if you sell alone, the buyer determines the price, but if you go as a team, you are able to bargain with the buyer, etc. So the side was basically saying that macro and benefits at the macro level and at the micro level. So now, what else? I think Mr. Kaduna covered that issue on permit. The registration of labor brokers. Currently, we register private employment agencies, and with the passage of the Employment Services Bill and the Labor Relations Amendment Act, there is a requirement that labor brokers must be registered. There was a question on 29, the type of co-ops, and again the slide just indicates the type of co-op, the membership, the degree of control, the ownership. And this is where the slide was basically say
if you have this type of a co-op where the workers control and the degree of control ranges from strategic policy, operational decision making, and the ownership resides mainly with the individuals, etc., you get different outcomes. So this slide was trying to summarize the types and different forms of worker co-ops. Obviously, it is not covering all the cooperatives. This was research done by colleagues in the department because of the ownership that is emerging amongst workers. Provision of assistance to co-ops and SMMEs, again, currently it is limited information because of the transfer, and I did indicate that we are a part of the bill embarking on pilots, and we have spoken to the unemployment insurance fund. The UIF is now involved or getting involved more and more in active labor market interventions, and this is precisely because a lot of workers who are losing jobs are finding it very difficult to get other jobs, either because of age and education levels and so on. And the question that is confronting all of us is the alternative ventures that we must initiate to make sure that some of these workers, some of them may be welders, having gained experience for years in factories, and plugging together, either bringing their pension funds together, etc. They can form various, very successful co-ops. We've seen some of them in countries like Germany, etc. The issue is how do you assist them? And again, the difficulty is that we have to rely on our sister departments, DTI for registration, education for education, and Department of Agriculture if it's land and all that. So there are interrelationships that we have to go through. And the list of co-ops per province, again, it's something that we don't have in the department, but we will have to rely on DTI to secure such information, because we don't register co-ops across the department.
Okay, I think we understand on that one, that if you can also, when the list of co-ops, and ask them for progress means on co-ops in provinces.
Yes, and that goes also with the monitoring tool that Honorable Swande was asking for. But I think Honorable Dow's proposal is the more practical one, where we come together and aspects that really fall within their control, they can give you a better perspective on some of those.
Thank you, Chair, and Honourable Members, thank you for the comments and the questions. We noted many of the suggestions and also the request, for example, for a copy of the First Decent Work Country Profile draft. We will follow up on that. I think we also would just want to certainly endorse and support your comments in respect of women's economic contribution and their work in general. I think my colleagues have covered many of the issues. I just want to very quickly touch maybe just on two or three issues. The one is this issue of our role and our mandate in respect of supporting enterprises and what we do. I mean, as a department, I think Mr. Motoba has pointed to the work with the UI and active labour market work is more to support individual workers to get into the labour market and into work. It's difficult for us to support enterprises and businesses, even though in the Decent Work Country program that is flagged as a very important outcome. But having said that, I mean, the Decent Work Country program does give us an opportunity, I think, to work a bit better with other departments on the issue of coordination that has come up. I do think we're able to make some progress. When you get a chance maybe to look at the implementation report, I just want to refer to page 17. There's a specific ILO project
to actually assist the National Department of DGI in developing a national informal business development strategy. So there the ILOs coming in with their labor market expertise to work with DGI on informal business development. And there, I mean, I'd like to think that's a good example of through the country program, some concrete steps of intervening, coordinating, trying to make a difference. There's also been a very important ILO-supported project under the Didn't Work Country Program to allow EDD, Economic Development Department, and the Ministry for Monitoring and Evaluation to create a tool and a method for assessing overall how well is government doing in job creation initiatives and support. So EDD is leading as that department, but again, it's got ILO support in the country program implementation report. So behind the scenes, I think this program is helping us to make some inroads on this issue. I just wanted to also just say that on the issue of labor broking, decent work, and the amendment, I mean, certainly I suppose the short answer is that many labor brokers do not currently provide work in conditions of freedom, equity, security and dignity. I think that is precisely why we need the tools that are in those amendments to start to regulate and make a difference to that decent work deficit that we find in many areas. Currently, we have a gap in our law. There's not much we can do. Even in respect of legal rights of workers who might be on a short-term contract with some labor broker, there are problems. And those amendments, which is to support my colleagues, are absolutely critical for us in taking forward an agenda. But Ted, just a final comment. I mean, I think decent work as a whole, I think it would be our view that it's not something you can point to and say decent work is 6,000 rand a month, 40 hours of work a week, something you're always working towards. We have to make sure that the rights are in place that we can enforce for people who work. But creating more decent and productive work, linking informal to formal, creating the channels, and that's an ongoing process that we just have to keep coming back to and saying how are we doing, are we making a difference? And I think the profile will help us to take things forward. Just a small practical issue that I wanted to add to what Mr. Motoba said, and speak to this issue of coordination, co-ops, and the inspectors, and what does our inspector do. We have started a discussion. It also came out of some of the cooperative work in the Decent Work Country Program, looking at developing a memorandum of understanding between our inspectors and the DGI around the issue of co-ops, because we've got a problem with the before the amendments come now to the Cooperatives Act, that we have to get specific delegations for our inspectors to go into co-ops and inspect whether those co-ops are even complying with the Unemployment Insurance Act and the Compensation Act, which they're required to do. And it took a long time to get the cooperation between the departments where we could send inspectors into the clothing co-ops that were working in KZN, where they were established to bypass the Labor Relations Act and the Basic Conditions of Employment Act. We're not talking about a formal MOU where we could maybe strengthen that cooperation and roll it out nationally, but it will take some time, but I think we will get there. Again, the inspectorate, of course, does take the role of advocating conditions and in co-ops and small business wherever. It's not always punitive. It is to try and advocate and support, but our mandate is not to support businesses as such, but more individuals. Thank you, Chip.
Thank you very much. I think members will agree with me if I say we still engage on this issue, because really
they are so important, and they will actually be of importance, they will assist in our community if we have taken them through what is happening in the Department of Labor. What I want to also encourage the department to do to say, I saw the minister advertising on TV that the UIF will be going to different malls in different provinces. So as we are around different provinces, if you see them, let's engage with them, find out what are the problems that they are encountering, and even members of the society, if we can have a word with them so that we understand what how they understand or how they appreciate what is happening in this department. I think on that note, I would... All right.
Yeah, that's a very important point that you made mention to. I don't know whether it's an international, is it international donor funding or that has got to do with the public procurement, and how can one access that fund? Say, for instance, I would want to assist whoever in my province.
It was the Flemish government that had project chair through you in the Free State, and the ILO access spoke to the Flemish government. I'll need to come back to you on another to see whether the ILO could assist in opening access, or, I mean, whether we could accept, approach it through the Decent for a Country program and then give it to the ILO and say, can you find some funding? Can you find a donor for this project? So that's an alternative route that might be simpler, is to come directly to the steering committee, say, here's a project in this province, can the program support?
Thank you very much. Let me thank the Department of Labor, Mr. Kassouda. Mr. Kassouda, thank you very much. You and your team, we really want to thank you for the information that you have given to us, and we will see you in the near future. The meeting stands adjourned.
Thank you very much.
And as usual, we thank you for the presentations that you sent early to us. That's why we are able to actually interact with you so robustly. Thank you very much. Keep it up. Honorable members, can you remain for the minute? Okay, all right. We will just distribute the minutes. We will see them next week. Hey, bom bobi. Okay, honorable members, thank you very much. The meeting stands adjourned. Until next week.
Yeah. And then you make ever be
that's a million
the towers was really the sound. I think it's easy.